This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
James was a farm boy. He got caught up in the war.
All right, welcome to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm going to be your guest host, Tom Perry. In today's show, we're going to have a discussion with Will Bagley. It's going to be kind of a wide-ranging of a discussion on Mormon's history in the West and a little bit about Will. And I'm very privileged and honored to have you on the show. How are you doing today, Will?
Oh, I'm feeling quite Sparky.
Great. Well, Will is currently an independent historian and a very prominent author. He's authored and edited many books, including Scoundrel's Tale, the Samuel Brannan Papers by Arthur H. Clarke Company, and you also co-authored with your brother, Pat Bagley, This is the Place, A Crossroads of Utah Past, a children's book. Judge Wilson McCarthy and the Rescue of the Denver and Rio Grande Western Railroad, by the USU Press in 2008. And one of my personal favorites, I'm sure we'll get to talk about quite a bit, is the multi-volume incredible series, The Kingdom of the West, by Arthur H. Clarke Company. It's going to have, what, 15 or 16 volumes?
Is that right? Something right around there.
Yeah, and volume 12, that I'm sure we'll talk about, of the Kingdom of the West series, is Innocent Blood, Essential Narratives of the Mountain Meadows Massacre that you co-edited with David Bigler. And of course, don't want to forget The Blood of the Prophets, Brigham Young and the Massacre at Mountain Meadows by the University of Oklahoma Press. And your most recent work that came out, I think, this month, So Rugged and Mountainous, Blazing the Trails to Oregon and California, 1812 to 1848 by University of Oklahoma Press. And you've also been in over a dozen documentaries like the A&E's Mountain Meadow Massacre, The Mormon Rebellion, and, of course, the acclaimed PBS special, The Mormons. So I really appreciate you joining us on the show tonight, Will.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And I wanted to, I just got So Rugged and Mountainous, Blazing the Trails to Oregon and California, on March 3rd. So it's only about 2 weeks old. And it's... I sat down and finally counted up how many books I've got my name on the spine.
Okay.
And it's 18.
18.
So this is my 18th baby, but I'm still really proud of it. And I wanted to show it to you, see how handsome it is.
Yeah, it's actually very big, yeah.
It's a big book. It's beautifully designed.
Yeah.
The typography in it is masterful. And it's even got a full cloth binding, which you don't find very much anymore. And it's very expensive. And I was not pleased at the $45 price when it came out. But I'll tell you what, it's worth it.
It's worth every penny, yeah.
And it's the first of four volumes of a series called Overland West, The Story of the Oregon-California Trails.
Excellent.
And this, I hope, will be my contribution to the history of the American West.
Excellent. And you also given me a small list of a dozen books that you're still currently working on, so you're actually quite busy.
I work 7 days a week.
7 days a week. You never take a break, huh?
Well, I should, but you know what? I really am driven by... I'm very goal-oriented. And I'm a workaholic. I love to work. And I, to put things in a broader perspective, I've long called myself the world's luckiest historian, and I am. I would argue with anybody who claims to be a luckier historian, because otherwise I wouldn't have survived. And I'm not an academic historian. I don't have a single advanced degree. I have a very good bachelor's in history from UC Santa Cruz, and I was ironically... a year behind Richard White, who is the dean of the New Western History, and Patty Limerick, who was in the class after me. and she is the queen of the new Western history. So it's quite an honor to be between two giants of Western history like that. And I hope I've somewhat done my bit. But I make my living as an independent consultant, lecturer, general expert, and therefore I'm a businessman.
So, well, first I want to ask you about this accusation that you get quite a bit about being an anti-Mormon writer. But before I do that, there's something I really wanted to ask you about, if you had any maybe insider information, is some of the recent documents that came up that the church had purchased. It was up for auction.
Oh, yeah. I saw those when they were listed on the auction sites.
Yeah, one of them, I guess, was a letter from Olive Frost, one of Joseph Smith's plural wives.
I don't know what the content of that was.
Okay, do you know if the church was able to purchase any of them, or do you know anything about that?
The church spent something north of $600,000.
Really?
But they didn't get all the stuff they wanted. Maybe they did get everything they wanted through agents and other
sure.
ways. But I don't think they got the deed to the the steamboat, the Nauvoo steamboat,
okay.
The Maid of Iowa. I don't think they got that. And all these items went for huge money. I was fascinated because the collection, which was a stamp collection, had, as I went through it, and I've copied off all the information to process it later, but it had a bunch of unknown overlands narratives that would qualify for an Overland Trails bibliography. And I've been working on that as part of my professional consulting work. And I've collected 500 editions to Mattis. Merrill
wow.
Mattis is the master bibliography of overland narratives. And Mattis counted 2,081 Platte River Road narratives that went basically up the Platte River and over South Pass. And that was in 1989. The church has just put up this absolutely phenomenal Mormon Pioneer Overland Company website. And if you search on any combination of that, you can go get there. And you can type in through their search engine your ancestors' names and see who they came west with, who mentions them, if they left any narratives. And they've transcribed more than 3,500
excellent.
Journals, yeah. sources, newspaper articles. So we might want to touch on how in the 20 years I've been doing Western history, or 20 years plus, everything's changed. It's a whole new ball game out there. And because of the net, a lot of people knew about this auction. And there were a couple of Mountain Meadows related items, letters from officers at Camp Floyd, in which in April 1859, they lay out that they pretty much have all the story. They know what happened. All the gory details. And that somewhat surprised me because I'd always thought that a lot of that didn't come out until the Army and the Indian agent had been to southern Utah, which happens in March and April. But in fact, there were people so horrified from Cedar City that they came up and told the story to federal authorities as soon as they could get through the terror, and they did. And one thing that I think is sort of lost in the Mormon obfuscation about Mountain Meadows is how horrified the ordinary people were. The only people that thought it was a good idea were the big bugs, the guys at the top, and they thought it was just a fine thing because they say they do. And they don't, they protect. They don't go and root out these murderers. They protect them.
Yeah, that's a pretty bad deal, that whole
it is, it's horrible. But the thing is, it's one of the patterns I see in Mormon history is the Mormon historians have always been ready to throw whoever is necessary under the bus to save the big guys. If you have to protect Brigham Young, who cares if you have to throw Isaac Haight to the dogs? And that's what the church has done in their new reinterpretation. They knew they couldn't keep hanging it on John D. Lee, so they had to throw somebody else under the bus. And who is it? It's President Haight. Anyway, well, we might talk about that more later. But so, well, you know, that first question, though, how do I respond to charges that I'm an anti-Mormon? This is, and like a lot of Utah speakers, I've been brought up in what is really a very emotional tradition. And I don't like it, but I tend to tear up at the drop of a hat. But I will try to read this. And this is from one of my most recent books. It is a book about a Utahn who was in 1932 and 1933 one of the seven most powerful men in the United States. His name is Wilson McCarthy. He was one of the seven directors of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And it was the Republicans' only attempt to cope with the Great Depression. And what did Herbert Hoover decide to do to save the economy? Lend billions of dollars to banks and corporations. And ultimately, the RFC lent $50 billion, which is the title of a bestseller that the director of the RFC wrote. And they did some good, but here's a man, here's a cowboy born and bred in Utah, raised in the on the plains of Alberta, who is suddenly put in this position of such immense power. He stays in Washington about 18 months. He doesn't like it. He's a Utah Democrat, but he is an Al Smith Democrat and doesn't like FDR. And he turns his back on it and walks away, goes back to the West. And to me, this is the kind of character that comes out of our culture, Mormon culture, that I find so compelling. And this is about, it's called The Cowboy Judge, and it's how Wilson McCarthy reflected the time and the country and the moral integrity that characterized leaders, the leaders who got us out of the Great Depression and won the Second World War. And I talk about a photograph taken in the late 1940s of one such man shows Wilson McCarthy, still trim in his mid-60s, but looking somewhat weary, seated on a paper-strewn desk, his hands folded before him, and a cuspidor gleaming on the windowsill behind him. Except for his obvious fitness, the judge appeared much like any other immaculately dressed captain of industry, but his massive, weather-beaten, and calloused hands almost leap out of the portrait. They seem to say, "This is not a tycoon. This is a cowboy." Like his working man's hands, Wilson McCarthy's character was shaped by his youth spent as a cowhand in the mountain valleys of Utah and on the Canadian prairie. The values he learned, that a man's word was his bond, that when you started a job, you were duty-bound to get it done, whether it was rounding up stray horses in Alberta or rescuing a railroad in Colorado, that a strong man had an innate responsibility to protect the weak and defenseless and help those in need, stuck with him for the rest of his life. They served him well, whether he was preaching the gospel in Scotland, battling prostitution in a Utah mining town, carousing with the Bohemian Club, or conferring with the President of the United States. But Wilson McCarthy was not simply a cowboy. He was a Mormon cowboy, a specialized breed. The first generation of Mormon cowboys were men born and bred on the frontier. And passing travelers often observed that they were as untamed as the desert country they called home. Some of the most colorful, notably Lot Huntington, Moroni Clausen, and John P. Smith, came to violent ends. But others, including Joseph F. Smith, Heber J. Grant, and J. Golden Kimball, became respected and beloved leaders of their church. Wilson came from a later generation of wranglers who had the advantage of being educated, but the ideals and principles he learned growing up as a young Latter-day Saint in American Fork shaped his actions for the rest of his life. So, Sounds like an anti-Mormon wrote that to me. But what that talks about, how much Wilson's background, even though he chewed tobacco and eventually he went, he was a counselor in the bishopric under Bryant Hinckley, who was Gordon B. Hinckley's father, who Wilson McCarthy gave a job during the war, so to keep keep Gordon Hinckley out of the conflict. But he went from being a second counselor at a very young age in the stake presidency, in Liberty Stake, the biggest stake in the church, to essentially becoming a nominal Latter-day Saint. And he kept up his membership. He was always proud of it, but he wasn't real active. Mormon identity was different when he grew up, and even different in the 1930s. And when one of his daughters was married in the temple, he had to go in 1948 and get a temple recommend. And he paid sort of a half tithing. But when he went in for the interview, his daughter told me that he told the bishop or stake president or whoever, ask me no questions, I'll tell you no lies. And they let him attend the marriage of his daughter.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is a policy that they should adopt for every father.
I agree.
But that same, you know, how much growing up Mormon affects your viewpoint and identity. I've grown to appreciate that more as I get older. But I've never really felt I could deny it. I sometimes jokingly say that when people ask me, what's it like being a Mormon? It's worse than being Jewish. Because it is. People have such a hard time leaving the tradition behind or making that emotional break with it. And a lot of people don't. They don't believe it anymore, but they stay under wraps. And I just didn't have the genetic makeup to do that. My mother told me a funny story, which one of my theories is that when you're raised Mormon, you either bond with it or you don't. And it either appeals to you and answers something in you, or it doesn't. And I was born without any religious genes whatsoever. I was a young skeptic, and I liked science, and I loved history, and I thought that church and church meetings were the most boring, pointless. And my mother, bless her memory, she died suddenly last fall. We were in Washington, D.C. to watch my brother Pat get the Herblock Award, which recognized Pat Bagley as the best cartoonist in the United States for 2008, anyway. Mm-hmm. And he was. He's the genius in the family. But we were back there, and my daughter flew to California and then flew Grandma out. And my mother was an indomitable personality. And my father had gone on to become mayor of Oceanside, California. And my mother was very used to politics in Washington. But she hadn't really adapted to the post-9/11 world. And we would come up to these long security lines and checks, and she would say, ignore them, just come on! And she'd go charging through barricades and everything else. And oftentimes, the people were just scared to try to stop her. But she told me that when I was about 7, me and my younger brother, Kevin, came and announced that we were going to go down to the ward house, and we lived right above the old East Mill Creek ward, right where Evergreen Avenue and I think 27th East or something come together. And it was the old run-down ward house where my grandfather had been bishop there for about 25 years. But we went, I told her, we're going to go down and get our names taken off the rolls because we don't want to go anymore.
How old were you at the time?
We left Utah when I was 9, so I think I had to be 7, maybe 8.
So you're still really young when you're doing that.
Oh, yeah. And I...
So you got baptized, and then it was just
a few
years later, you're...
Well, I remember I got baptized in the tabernacle, in the old ox tank.
No kidding.
And I can't remember, I think my father baptized me, but he was only a priest.
Okay.
And he smoked, drank coffee, and I think my father baptized me, but he may have had, somebody else may have done it. But I've been told all these, everything, you're going to feel so different, and it's going to be so neat, and I remember driving away going, I don't feel at all different. So, I'm just a born skeptic, and when I was about, I was someplace between 12 and 14, and I can date that because of a book, and I've got the book right here on the shelf. It is Bernard DeVoto's edition of Mark Twain's Letters from the Earth.
Okay.
And if anyone wants to free themselves from primitive Christianity, or more correctly, fundamentalist Christianity, because this is Twain's deconstruction of the frontier religion he was raised in, which sounds Baptist, but I think the Clemens were Methodists or Presbyterians or something. But he just takes on the Bible stories and... some of the letters are Satan's letters from Earth, and Satan isn't quite the personification of evil that he is in Mormon Annals. But he's just sort of a visitor, and he's going, you wouldn't believe the stories these people tell. And then he runs down the Bible, and it's just hilarious. But I read that, and it was like the Communist Manifesto was to young revolutionaries in Europe. It was just like a clarion call to freedom, and it liberated me. I really felt this sense of liberation, intellectual liberation, and I did go to seminary in high school in California, which you know is quite a different drill than it is in Utah.
It is here, yeah.
I got up at 5:30 in the morning, and I still get up real early.
So you're going to seminary, and you're experiencing this intellectual brightening at the same time, huh?
Yeah. Well, but I was also the wise ass who asked the hard question. Who'd Cain marry? Or, you know, and we had some very bright teachers. And ironically, one of my friends who went to seminary with me, was Melvin Johnson. And Melvin Johnson and I have both won the John Whitmer Best Book Award. And Melvin got it for Polygamy on the Pedernales, the Lyman White Colonies in Texas.
Oh, wow.
And so it was quite a bright class. And we had a Marine Corps doctor, Dr. Plautz, who would come in early in the morning drinking it wasn't even diet, because I don't think they had diet drinks in 61 or 2, drinking Pepsis, just one Pepsi after another. And he later, his liver gave out or something. Oh. But Plautz was really a very bright guy and very entertaining. And so I really liked the church history I got. Then we had some not quite so bright teachers. And I went to everything but the Book of Mormon. Because you only had to graduate, you only had to go for 3 years. And the last thing in the world was I wanted to sit through was the Book of Mormon.
Had you read it?
I think my mother gave me either $5 or $20. I think it was $5 because that was a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
If I'd read all the Book of Mormon,
right? Didn't you?
I was about 12, and I'd read Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey and the Aeneid, and I was fascinated by Greek myths. I was deep into archaeology.
Wow!
And so I started reading this, and I go, "This isn't an ancient text. Give me a break." And I go, "This is, listen to this. It's the American frontier all over it." And you know, even that young, I just go, "Come on!" And then I got to, "And the sword of Laman was made out of steel." I go, "Wait a minute, it's 600 BC. So I went and looked up, when did they invent steel? Well, Laman didn't have a sword made out of steel. That's a pretty sure thing. But by the end of it, and then, you know, it really is, it gets so incredibly tedious. And why, if Joseph Smith was going to plagiarize the Bible, why couldn't he plagiarize one of the interesting parts? What's this with the Isaiah, who does absolutely nothing for me in whichever translation? But, and then you get almost to the end, and it's as if the author had this sudden inspiration for one of the first science fiction stories. And we have the Jaredites, and the Tower of Babel, and these barges that are tight like a dish. And I'm thinking, barges, tight like a dish? And, you know, okay, the book is being written where? Well, right next to the Erie Canal. And what do they have? They have barges that they're hauling up and down the canal. So if you want to describe a submarine, it's like an upside-down barge is how it's described. But it's tight like a dish. Except you've got all your animals, you've got 2 years supply of food, and no air, and magic lights, magic rocks for lights. And then, because of the problem of carbon dioxide, I don't think Joseph Smith didn't know about carbon dioxide, but when it leaks or something,
yeah, they open holes, they pull it, if water comes in, then you plug it and go the other direction so they can get air.
Yeah. Anyway, but you know, come on, you got to give the guy credit. That's a pretty inventive story.
Sure.
And then he just keeps repeating the same story. The moral calculus of the Book of Mormon is God likes poor people, and poor people are righteous. But when people are righteous, they get rich. And when they get rich, they get sinful. And when they get sinful, God doesn't like them anymore, and he punishes them, and they become poor again. And when they're poor, they are again righteous. And because they are righteous, they become wealthy. And because they become wealthy, they become sinners. And it just goes on and on and on. And so what's the moral message of the Book of Mormon? What's the moral message of the Rock of Sisyphus? But then, at the end, you get this horrendous wipeout. And it's sort of like the Book of Ether. Yeah, the Book of Ether is sort of a warm-up for what's to come. But the Book of Ether is really over the top with Shiz chopping off the head of Coriantumr, you know, and they both kill each other. Everybody's dead except for Jared and his brother. No, his brother's dead too, or something.
Yeah.
But there's, they come staggering out of the woods to find who? The Nephites, who then repeat the whole thing over again, repeatedly, and finally they go to upstate New York and wipe each other out. You got to say, that is a pretty creative folk frontier novel. But to pretend that it's history, and to have all this money that's spent, and all these great experts on Nephite armor and war tactics and Nephite law and Mormon as a historian as compared to Moroni as a historian. Well, you know, the way my vision of how historians work is you're dependent on sources. And you have to be very skeptical about the nature of your sources. But this is the only source that's single-sourced, where you've got one source for all this stuff. And the original manuscript has been reclaimed by the authors. It was translated back to heaven. It was actually moved back to heaven. It was translated by Joseph Smith, who, except for these 12 other guys, was the only one who could see it. His wife couldn't see it. His father-in-law couldn't see it. And man, was he steamed. And it was so holy that nobody could look at it. But it was so tempting, because it was made out of gold, that somebody could steal it. And Joseph had to run with it to escape guys who wanted to steal it.
Yeah.
But a block of gold that weighed 6 inches by 6 inches, or was 6 inches by 6 inches by 6 inches, would weigh, well, at best, several hundred pounds. So, you know, this is a story, if you're going to accept it, you have to accept it on faith.
Yes.
And I was a man of little faith, and still am. And really, am an agnostic. I'm not an atheist. And I'm typically not wishy-washy about things. But I think that the critics of atheism, militant atheism, have a point when they say, well, it's just another form of belief. And my take on it, and I once talked to Sterling Moren about this. Sterling is, I think, the greatest philosopher Mormonism's ever produced, and another Mormon cowboy of Wilson McCarthy's generation. And he once actually was kind enough to give me the time, and I said, as I thought about it, the great secret of life is that none of us know the answer to anything. And Sterling said, well, ever since Socrates, people have pointed out that we don't have the answers to the most important questions. But to me, I find immense comfort in the fact that as mortal human beings, we're all confronted with the same mysteries. And we're all equally ignorant before them. And whether you claim to be the Pope of Uruk or the successor of St. Peter or the anointed prophet of the Lord or the one powerful and mighty, powerful and mighty. In fact, you have no more certainty about what the ultimate nature of spiritual reality is than the poorest, lowliest Hottentot on the desert. And it's that equal ignorance before the mysteries of life that I think may well be to me, it's the resolution of the injustice you see everywhere. That no matter how powerful and rich you are, you still don't know. But you have to believe something. And it's that moral demand that you have to believe something. You have to figure out what it is you believe. And so, although I don't believe in religion, and I think a lot of it's silly, I do have a lot of respect for people's religious beliefs. And that it certainly includes Mormons. And I know I just made fun of the whole history mythology, but it works for a lot of people. It speaks to them. It answers their questions. It provides them a value system. It leads people to live very good lives. And in this So Rugged and Mountainous, I talk about what an important role religion plays in the history of our overland trails. Because religion was an immense consolation to people. A friend of mine, who I mentioned in this, recently lost his daughter, and he's now an Episcopalian. And he told me how much comfort he found in that belief system. And we're all equally ignorant before the mysteries. But what works for people, I'm not going to question any of that. And everyone has their right to believe whatever they want. And I do have a respect for what religion can bring to people.
So you do have a respect for spirituality. Do you find yourself with some sort of spirituality? You say you're agnostic, so maybe there's some sort of power that you may connect with.
You know, for me, what it really boils down to is, I think my religion is history and science, really. I'm a secularist. My moral belief system is tied to the good of humanity, that we're all brothers and sisters. Genetically, we're all cousins. In Utah, we're all literal cousins. But we're someplace back there, I'm a cousin of Barack Obama. And someplace way back there, I'm a cousin of Mao Zedong. And we're all one. We're bonded that way. Right. Our humanity is our bond. And I very deeply believe in the principles of humanism, which is what all the great religious teachers have taught, which is do unto others as other you would have others do unto you, and that I really am a Manichaeist, too.
Right.
I see a conflict between good and evil. And I think what the animating forces of life are there's a powerful, positive life force. And the purpose of life on Earth is to create more life. What drives every living thing? A compulsion to reproduce.
Sexual drive.
In one form or another.
Yeah.
If it's a cell, it's to split and make more right. cells. And I felt this profoundly in my own psychology and makeup. And I know how much joy and satisfaction I take from my children. But to me, that's what I see in as whatever forces there are. And I think there's a malignant force, because I don't see how moral or religious systems account for the problem of evil. That, to me, is a real tough philosophical nut.
Yeah.
But it's the countervening forces, that there is a power of death and destruction and the anti-life force, because everything dies. Everything is in some strange balance that we don't understand. And I don't see that my particular single religious identity or a particular individual identity is at all necessary for the greater cosmos. And I very much adapted to that, and I had a conversation with my grandmother when she was not long before she died. And she said something, I was in my 20s at the time, and I hadn't really thought through a lot of things, but she said something very profound to me. She had been a lifelong Latter-day Saint and was just an absolutely beautiful, charming, old Mormon matriarch, and lovable as could be. But she said to me, "You know, I've never really worried about me disappearing. If I don't live past death, that wouldn't really bother me." But she said, "What would really hurt is not being able to see the people I love ever again." And you know, that's part of the reason religion offers so much consolation to people, because to be able to think that someday we'll all be together again. But we don't know. And my grandfather, who I think I told you is one of the, I've met a handful of Christians in my life, and my grandfather's one of them, and he told me, He lived to be within a month of being 101. And he outlived my grandmother by about 15, 16 years. And he told me in his last years that he felt God had forgotten him. And it was heartbreaking. Because he was such a decent, lovable, honorable man, and such a good Christian. A man who really did try to live like Jesus Christ. But he'd been a bishop forever. He'd been a Hawaiian mission president. He once told me that the Mountain Meadows Massacre never happened. Oh. But about the same time he told me that sad story, he said, I really am looking forward to dying because I want to see if all this crazy nonsense I've believed all these years is true. And that's a very positive way to look at it, I think.
I think so too.
But you know what? I wanted to talk a little bit about how being raised Mormon, how much that attracted me to history. Yeah. And I remember I used to live on East Mill Creek, and on Evergreen Avenue, mm-hmm. every July 4th, we'd have a parade from the East Mill Creek Ward House down to the park where the Lions Club still serves breakfast, and every 4th of July. And we'd dress up in patriotic costume or something. And one year, my mom had a big coal scuttle, and so we took Pat, who was the youngest of the boys, and Kevin and I dressed up as cannibals, and we put Pat in the pot, and we wrote breakfast on it. Now, this was in the 1950s, remember. This was when race and those issues was very different. Yeah. These are the days of Tarzan. but I also remember going up to summer school at East Mill Creek Elementary and putting together a float for the children's parade of the days of 47 and then marching in the children's parade. And some of that had to have rubbed off. And the stories of Mormon history are so epic, and they were so compelling, that I think my lifelong passion for history goes back to those origins. But I look also at some of the cultural artifacts now. This was a Mormon religion that a lot of young people wouldn't recognize. And it was easy for this Rocky Mountain religion in a state that had maybe 0.2 black population to marginalize people of color because there weren't many. And the church, to its credit, had included Polynesians, and there had been some debate about whether they were sons of Ham or whatever.
Right.
But it wasn't a big tent. And it was a very parochial, regional religion.
Yeah.
And when I went to California when I was 9, that became a much harder issue. Because we had lots of Polynesians in our ward. And there were lots of Mexican-American and black kids in my classes. We lived right next to the Marine Corps base. And so it was a completely different world. And all of a sudden, the sons of Ham weren't these remote, faceless, scary black people. They were George and Henry and Wendell and Otis. And
so you started seeing things differently?
Very early. And I also saw old traditions of Mormonism, which is... my father was interviewed by, not long after we got there. And as I said, he'd had this very troubled 1950s when he was in his 20s and had survived a nervous breakdown. And then J.D. Williams, the great political scientist, had gotten him back into University of Utah, and he'd gotten a degree, and got a job as an assistant city planner. And we moved to California and joined the Oceanside Carlsbad ward. And the brethren called my dad in for an interview or something. And they told him, "We know a lot more about you than you think." Now, what kind of Christian counseling is that?
Yeah.
And then we have our bishop. They divided the wards. They divided into the Carlsbad ward, which, as it turned out, was all white. And then they divided the Oceanside ward, which wasn't. And so most of the Utah-born elite leadership had gone to Carlsbad, and we were left with a more rural, funky style of Mormon leadership. And so we got Bishop Bounds, and Bishop Bounds was a gardener for the city of Oceanside. So he was a city employee like my dad. And he was an old Southern boy, I think. And he had a daughter named Loretta who was interesting. But Bishop Bounds was different than the Carlsbad Mormons and was a country boy. And so I went to him for my priesthood interviews. And I think it was I only made it to teacher. I never became a priest.
Even now?
I'm still the world's oldest teacher. And it may have been that this was the question that pretty much stopped my eternal progression.
Oh, no.
But in one of those interviews, Bishop Bounds asked me, you know, they ask you if you choke the chicken and other odd things, but he asked me, "Do you have sex with animals?"
And I'm what?
He asked me, "Do you have sex with animals?"
For real? He really asked that?
That used to be a standard rural Mormon question. This came out in the handbook. But I sat there, and you know what my first thought was?
I'm shocked.
No. You can have sex with animals? I hadn't even conceived of the idea.
So it gave you ideas, huh?
No! I mean, why would you want to have sex with an animal?
Yeah.
We weren't in Idaho. We weren't in Wyoming. We were in Oceanside. The only animals we had were dogs and cats. But we didn't have chickens. But I was having lunch with Marlon Church historian now, and is really an amazingly charismatic and one of the a church leader who I've met who I really think has a deep spiritual nature, and who I have a great respect for. He's not much of a historian, but he was an attorney and he worked for my grandfather, and so we have a lot of mutual interest, and I really do like him. I really do like Rick Turley, who's now assistant church historian.
Yeah.
But Marlon asked me what led to my leaving the church, and I told him the story about sex with animals, and he looked just pained. But I think he knew he'd probably been asked the same question. He grew up in Huntsville. Had to ask those boys.
That's insane to think that was part of the handbook question. So what led up to your eventual interest in Mormon history? So you've kind of gone a little bit more skeptic, and you still find your way connected to Mormonism,
well,
actually very deeply, right?
Only intellectually.
Yeah, only intellectually, yeah.
But pretty profoundly that way. But I was a child of the 60s, and I graduated from high school when I just barely turned 17. I went to BYU for a year, the longest decade of my life, and I went only because I had a scholarship and I wanted to transfer to Stanford. And I did get into Stanford, but I got a scholarship to UC. And It was funny because while I was at BYU, my uncle, who was a country doctor in American Fork and had been a spy in the Second World War, amazing, amazing guy, Delbert Hales, and really very bright graduate of University of Pennsylvania Medical School, a German Hawaiian missionary. And he'd found the bodies where the Germans had executed American officers as part of the Battle of the Bulge.
Oh, wow.
He was a scout who found them.
Wow.
But Delbert was really quite a character. And he took me one morning, it was Sunday morning, up to the, he drove me up to the country club. And he told me about all the women who had come to his office almost on a weekly basis and offered to run away to Las Vegas with him.
Oh, really?
And he told me about what he called the country club set. And it, you know, this is American Fork Country Club, so. But he said, you know, the way I look at it, and he pretty much made clear, he didn't believe in the Golden Bible and all that stuff.
Right.
But he liked Mormon culture a lot. And it answered stuff in him. And he thought it was a good way to raise his kids.
Hmm.
And it gave him a sense of moral certitude and center. Maybe not certitude, but he just said it was a better life. These people are all cheating on their wives. They got problems with alcohol.
Right. And,
they really live pretty meaningless, hollow lives. And as silly as the church is, it gives you a good, decent moral life. And ironically, I had the same conversation. And from my Uncle Dell, I could see his point. It wasn't for me. But I also had a very similar conversation with a BYU professor. And I think somebody told me to go talk to him about transferring to Harvard, because he'd been to Harvard. And we had a very similar conversation. And my left a very distinct impression on me that he didn't believe in Mormonism. But he said, it's a very good life, and it's a very good value system. And you ought to consider sticking with it, because it'll give you that. And I walked out of the door, and I said, that's the worst advice I've ever had in my life. But I had the distinct impression that Richard Bushman was not a believer.
Really?
And my sense is that he has since become maybe more of a believer. But it is still, I think, to this day, to live a lie, I just don't have it. And I can see I know a lot of people do it, and I know it works for a lot of people, and that's their life. But I just don't have the moral ambiguity to practice something that I don't believe. And I think a lot of people in Utah certainly are trapped into it, because what are you going to do? Lose your job, your family, your whole life, all your values? And if it works for you, well, those compromises are probably worth it. But I just couldn't go that route. Hmm. And I just found tremendous exhilaration and freedom and humanist values. The proper study of mankind is man. And that's another interesting thing that sets me apart from most historians and most formal Mormon historians is I'm self-trained.
Right.
I got a very good undergraduate training. I studied under John Dezikis, who was a brilliant historian. He won the National Book Award for a book on opera. His compelling, challenging lecture style is the model for how Patty Limerick wrote Legacy of Conquest. And so I had a good fundamental education. But then I went off and I spent 14 years or so as a itinerant carpenter, tobacco farmer, musician, cabinet maker. I finally got married. I had a country rock band. I recorded that album.
Incredible.
But the whole time, and I lived in North Carolina in the Smoky Mountains, mm-hmm. I learned to play folk music and bluegrass music. and I was part of the Back to the Land movement, and I went through. I took a raft trip down the Mississippi River, and I did that in college, and it was this attempt to recreate the 19th century, a conscious attempt. So I'd had something of an experience of how do you approach the past? Can you go out and experience it? And America is still very good. You can still walk across the Oregon-California Trail. Those wagon trains in 1997, my friend Joseph Johnson and his wife walked all the way from Nauvoo. Walked. They literally recreated the old standard. And I met Joseph coming out of Immigration Canyon. He was rail thin. There wasn't an ounce of anything but muscle on the boy.
Well, did he get closer to God? I mean, isn't that, what kind of?
Oh, I don't think that. I think people got closer to life, to reality. Some people
maybe just finding ways to connect with some of those people.
Well, just to be out in nature like that.
That's true.
A very deep.
Yeah.
To me, one thing, our lives are so artificial, and so we're so insulated from reality, and reality being nature.
Right.
How much experience do any of us have with hunger? People who crossed the plains got hungry, real hungry.
Especially the hand carts and stuff.
So they get killed people. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because no Mormon authorities ever tell incoming immigrants it was meant to be hard. It was supposed to be tough because now you've made that sacrifice. Now you're part of the group. You've bonded. You've made that. You've proved that you're worthy of Zion. And now here you are. And they've been told, most people converting to Mormonism in England had been told about this paradise in the Rocky Mountains. And they got here and they saw an arid, barren desert. And most of the arable land was already long taken up, and they could work for peanuts. And my own ancestors wound up living in dugouts, eating grass in the Great Famine of 1856-55. But still, people had this immense spiritual bonding experience. And some didn't. Some came out and were just disgusted by the exploitation they saw going on. And Jedediah Grant once said, how many people who cross the plains and come out here become good Latter-day Saints? I'm afraid it's not more than half. So even by the church authority standards, not very many people were actually sticking with it. And I'm working on a book about Mormon dissidents, people who left the faith for one reason or another. Hmm. And you'd probably argue that there have been more people who've left Mormonism than have actually joined and stayed with it. But it's a dynamic situation. And for some people, it just worked. And on the larger issue, I have to answer the question, or at least ask it, in my trail opus. Did going west between 1840 and 1870 make people's lives better? Well, it made some people's lives better, and it killed a lot of people. But was it overall a win or a loss? And it's a very subtle, it's a very tough question, and it requires a pretty subtle answer. But I think a lot of the perspective is that, well, and it's something that I've come to appreciate more, they got into the West. And if nothing else, it gave them this opportunity that their children would have, and their children's lives were better. And as children of the West, as a child of the West, boy, I appreciate it.
Sure, me too.
And I recall meeting an old man who was living in a shack right above the East Mill Creek Ward House, who had been a pioneer, who had walked across the plains. So, time is not as... we're not as distant from the past as it might seem. I was able to interview in 2008 and 2009 a grandson of a survivor of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Milam Alexander Jones is now, when I met him, he just turned 85. And he'd been an all-star center for Rice University and been victorious in the Cotton Bowl. And he was taught to read by his grandfather, Felix Marion Jones. And Jones grew up to be this 6'2", 6'4", cashmere farmer, goat rancher in the Caliche Hills of Texas, and was an infant. He had no living memories of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, but he'd been told by one of the older girls, probably Rebecca Dunlap. That's who he said told him, that when the massacre happened, he says he was in his father's arms, which doesn't really track with what we know, but that the girl said that Felix Marion was an infant, and he got a head wound. Head wounds bleed a lot. And when they gathered up the children, as John D. Lee says, we collected 16 children and took them to Hamlin's Ranch. Some people say 17, but I say 16. And they'd left Felix Marion Jones on the field of the murder, the killing fields. And Rebecca Dunlap told them that there was a surviving baby out there. And when they went the next day to bury him, they found him. And the family, Felix Marion, taught Milam Alexander to read out of the family Bible. And he was an amazingly simple, primitive Baptist Christian. But again, a real, true Christian. And when I interviewed Milam Alexander, I saved one question for last, which was, what did your grandfather tell you about the Mormons? And he said, well, Felix Marion claimed that he could remember playing with Indians, and that the couple that had him treated him well, that they loved him as much as if he were their own kid. And Milam said to me, I don't recall my grandpa ever saying anything hard about the Mormons. He said, but the next generation, that was different. But the Jones family preserved the only authentic artifact I've ever seen of the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
Which was what?
It was the linen Woolsey suit that Felix Marion wore across the plains.
No kidding.
It was staggering. It's about set up for a 3 or 4 year old boy. It has scorch marks on it. And Milam said that Felix told him it had been in it, or that it was, no, that he remembered it being in a house fire. But as I looked at it, I thought, no, the kid got too close to the fire. But they have it framed now, and it's hanging in his son's house. But to me, that's the only... I've heard about candlesticks and swords and lots of weapons, lots of firearms. Almost all the firearms post-date 1857, so they're obviously fake. But most artifacts are dead things. But that suit speaks. That suit tells a story that it's just a stunning artifact. But anyway, so what got me back into Mormon history? I had become a carpenter, and I came back to Utah because I wanted to see my grandparents, and they were both in their 80s, well into their 80s. And in 1976, I got with a friend and hitchhiked back to Utah. And I remember coming down Parley's Canyon, and there was finally a freeway. I remember an old two-lane road up Parley's, and we came down on the freeway, and you get that wonderful view of the valley.
Sure.
And I could look down, and I could see this big skyscraper blocking the view of the temple. And so I go, geez, I wonder who built that skyscraper. I'll bet you the church is pissed off about that.
Not knowing it was the church you're building?
It was a cob. It was the church I was building. Yes. Of course I should have known nobody would build a building like that.
Unless it was the church.
Unless it was the church. But, and I, you know, the thing that's really struck me was I'd moved from North Carolina, and I had come out of this lush, verdant, very wealthy, well, in terms of resources, very fertile, golden place. And I came into Utah after being in the Smoky Mountains, and it looked like a stark, barren desert. And I thought, well, how come everybody back in Madison County is poor as dirt, and all these people, as far as you can see, there are nice, comfortable houses, well-trimmed yards, industrious people. And then as you go around, mansions up on the hillsides. And they didn't go as far in 1975, but it struck me as what a contrast between the poverty of the South in the midst of these natural wonders and the wealth of Utah in the midst of all this desolation.
Well, this will end part one of our discussion with Will Bagley. We had to break this up into two parts. And as you can tell, the music's a little bit different for the intro and the outro bumper music on this podcast. The music was actually provided to us by Will Bagley from his album, The Legend of Jesse James, that he did back in 1979. So I want to give a shout out to Will for letting us have some of his music to put in for the podcast. I think it's kind of fun and different. So please tune in to part two of our discussion with Will Bagley. And remember, the discussion always continues at MormonExpression.com, and you can mail for any comments or suggestions or criticism at mail@MormonExpression.com, or call us at 801-906-6722.
So awful good, never liked it anyhow. It's like the old man dreaming, talking in the dark. Son, it's too much pain to pay. Farming will break your heart. Say goodbye to Frank and Jess, goodbye to both my sons. Say goodbye to Ma and Pa. Just tell them that I'm gone. Well, I believe I'll go to the western lands, preaching the land of gold, saving the miners from their sins where the winters are deep and cold. And sure enough, my darling, I'll send for you down the line.
Then I had to turn away, didn't want him to see me cry.
So say goodbye to Frank and Jess,
goodbye to both my sons. Say goodbye to Ma and Pa. Just tell them